the series Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday night of this week is designed to take a look at the evidence for God in the natural world. And I'm convinced that He has a grand testimony in another book besides the Bible. And it is that to which we'll turn our attention this evening. So thank you for being here. Now, I want to do something at the beginning here that it'll be a little introductory. I bring books with me when I do this series, and I want to introduce you to some books that I think are very valuable and can be useful in your own personal study. And I had three of them last night that I forgot to tell you about. So I'm going to start with that so I don't forget it again. And I also will tell you, I'm going to leave Brother Gene a copy of a bibliography that has all these books and many more in it that I recommend for those of you who want to do your own personal study. But I brought three books with I want to share with you before we start tonight. This one is designed to be for somebody at junior high level. It's called Explore Evolution. I think it's an excellent book. It approaches it from a standpoint much like what I do. We look at the evidence of the natural world and we show the different interpretations for that evidence. It's an excellent beginning book for you. Explore Evolution. I highly recommend it. A second one here is I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. It's by Norman Geisler and Frank Turek. Excellent book. It covers all the topics that you need to study for evidences, all the way from why we believe in God to why we believe the Bible's the Word of God to why we believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God. All of those topics are covered in this little book, and I highly recommend it to you. We have used it at our congregation for our young people for a whole series of quarters. It's well worth reading. And then the third one I want to mention to you is this one. It's called The Language of God by Francis Collins. You probably don't know Francis Collins. Francis Collins led the group of people across the world who mapped the human genome in the early 2000s. He was one of the leaders of that movement. And so is very knowledgeable about the human genome. And he wrote a book called The Language of God. He's a believer in God. He believes in evolution also. So there's some things about him I don't agree on. But this little book is worth reading because it sets forth some reasons why he is a believer in the God of creation. Okay. So those are the three introductory books. Now let's get to the lesson at hand. Last night, if you were here, we referred to this website. It's called Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI for short. This is a portion of their website in which they describe what their purpose is. So let me read you just a little piece of that first paragraph. SETI. The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence is an exploratory science that seeks evidence of life in the universe by looking for some signature of its technology. Now, I like to start there because we built our case on that last night, didn't we? I think it's a perfectly legitimate scientific enterprise for them to be looking for evidence of intelligent life out there in the universe somewhere. How would you go about that? Well, they're seeking for some signature of technology. And what I showed you last night is they're looking for radio signals that are narrow band signals that contain information. And they are convinced if they find such a thing out in outer space, that would be fantastic evidence that there's intelligent life out there. And I would simply say to you, if that's a good search for the signs of intelligence, then why not do something like that here on Earth? I believe there are signs of intelligent design all over the place here on Earth. So with that introduction, I want to turn your attention now to some things we can study right here that also point to intelligent design. But let's start with a couple of Bible scriptures as we did last night. Since we're having this in a church building, It is my custom when we do that to refer to the text of the Bible first. Now please understand, if I were doing this in a college lecture hall, I would make no reference to the Bible whatsoever. I don't believe it's necessary to discuss this subject. In fact, I believe it sometimes interferes when you're talking with someone who doesn't even believe in God to make reference to the Bible. I think it's best not to do that when you're discussing with an atheist. But we're in a church building. Most of you here are Bible believers, as am I. So I want to start with Psalm 8. Psalm 8 says, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth, you who set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouths of babes and infants you have ordained strength because of your enemies, that you may silence the enemy and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you visit him? For you have made him a little lower than the angels and crowned him with glory and honor. You have made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, even the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and those things that pass through the paths of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. One of many passages in the Bible that testifies that you can look at the natural world and see evidence for God. Psalm chapter 8. Now I think the most powerful of all passages in the Bible is found in Romans 1:20. And it's the theme passage for this series if you're going to refer to the scripture. Romans 1 verse 20 says the following: For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, even his eternal being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. This passage argues, ladies and gentlemen, that you can see God even though you can't see him. How do you see the invisible attributes of God? This passage says you see them through the things that are made. The argument is, if this has been made, then clearly something made it. And so it's the argument from design. And so my point to you in the audience who are Bible believers is that the Bible itself makes the argument that I'm going to be making in this series. The evidence of the natural world points to a maker. It's the argument from design. In fact, this passage argues that you can see his invisible attributes by the things that are made. And what can you see? You can see that whoever this being is must be eternally powerful and must not be a part of this world, must be divine. Those things you can determine by examining the things that are made. So for the rest of our time tonight, please take no offense if you're a Bible believer that I'm not going to use the Bible again until the end of this lesson. I'm turning away from the Bible and turning to God's other book, because he gives grand testimony in another book, the book of the natural world. So, I repeat, if I were doing this in a college lecture hall, I would not refer to the Bible at all. We'd refer only to the evidence of the natural world. I think that's the appropriate thing to do in that setting. And by the way, I've done it lots of times. So you remember the reference in the website for the SETI organization said they're looking for some signature of its technology? There's a new book out called Signature in the Cell, by Stephen Meyer. I highly recommend it to you. I brought it to show you how thick it is. This is not light reading. But it's got a whole mix of things in it. It is a history book. It tells the story of the uncovering of this wonderful information that we've learned, most of which we've learned since the 1950s, ladies and gentlemen. We've learned more about how the living things function at the chemical level since the 1950s than in all the history of mankind prior to then. You are so fortunate to live in this age because we've uncovered more secrets about how life works than all the history of mankind put together. The last 60 years have been utterly amazing. And one of the most wonderful things about the last 60 years was the discovery of the signature in the cell. And there was no mistake in picking that word. Dr. Meyer picked that word purposely in reference to what I read you from the website by the SETI organization. They're looking for some signature of technology. He says there's one right here in every cell. Wake up! I highly recommend that book to you as well. And we'll be making reference to it and, of course, a lot of other material in the course of this discussion. Now, I've been calling you my class because this is a lecture. So you're my class tonight. And I want to make a couple of observations at the beginning. We're going to be studying chemistry class. Chemistry. Because life is chemistry. And chemistry is a study of life. I hope you're excited. Now, here's my second observation. If you start falling asleep on me, I make you stand up. I don't allow sleeping. So just plan to stay with me because this is exciting material as we look closely at how living things work, which I hope will testify to you in a more grand way than you've ever seen, that somebody made this. This did not just happen by natural causes. I read a quote last night from Dr. Anthony Flew, professor of philosophy, former atheist and debater. For many years, he debated creationists and said that their position was foolish and not supported by the evidence. In his 80th year, in 2004, Dr. Flew made this statement. It now seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research have provided materials for a new and enormously powerful argument to design. And Dr. Flew, the former atheist, has become a believer. Some God did this. Nature didn't do this. And that's what I want to talk to you about tonight. I appreciate a man who in his 80th year will change his mind about something as significant as belief in God. Now, understand, Dr. Flew doesn't believe in the God of the Bible yet. I hope he will one day. But he certainly believes there had to be some God that did what we found out about DNA. And it is that to which we will turn this evening. And it's going to be like this, class. We're going to look at evidence. I'm going to try my best to get you to understand what we've learned about life at the chemical level. And when we get finished, I'm going to ask you the question, which is more reasonable? Did that come about by natural causes, by some evolutionary process, small changes over long periods of time, by the blind forces of physics? Or is it more reasonable to say there was an intelligent design behind this? Which is more reasonable? That's what we're going to ask you. And you will be the judge. Every person's going to have to judge this for himself. So now, let's talk, class, about how life on Earth functions. And by the way, life as we know it on Earth is the only life anybody knows anything about. People hypothesize about there being life out there somewhere in the universe, but we've never found the first scintilla of evidence of it. UFOs and little green men to the contrary notwithstanding. So life as we know it here on Earth is the life we know anything about. So what is it like? Well, I thought I would quote to you from a little book by Francis Crick. And if you're a biology student, you should certainly know who Francis Crick is. He and James Watson were given credit in 1953 for discovering the structure of DNA. They received the Nobel Prize for that grand discovery. So if anybody knows anything about how life functions, it's Dr. Francis Crick. So he wrote a little book called Life Itself, Its Origin and Nature. And so I want to read just a little bit from this book to you as we begin. I'm going over here to page 72, and as I do, you watch the screen here, and he will describe to you some things about life. Life as we know it on Earth appears as a synthesis of two macromolecular systems. And I just lost half of you, right? Macro means big, right? Molecular means it's made of molecules. He says life as we know it has two huge systems of molecules. The proteins, because of their versatility and chemical reactivity, do all the work, but are unable to reproduce themselves in any simple way. So the first great class of molecules is the proteins. The proteins are the structural materials for living things, the things that make their shape and mobility. The proteins are also the tools and machinery. We call them enzymes. Enzymes are special types of proteins, and they take care of the growth and maintenance of living things. But please note, class, both of those are proteins. They are the workhorses of living things. The problem with proteins is they don't reproduce themselves. Are you with me so far? Proteins do a lot of work, but they can't reproduce themselves. Which leads us to the second great class. He calls them the nucleic acids. They seem tailor-made for reproduction, but can achieve rather little else compared with the more elaborate and better equipped proteins. So, the blueprints of living things, called the nucleic acids, otherwise known as DNA and RNA, are good for reproduction, but not much else. So those molecules can reproduce themselves, but they can't do the work. Then he goes on to say, the problem of the origin of life would be a great deal easier to explain or to approach if there were only one family of macromolecules capable of doing both jobs. But life as we know it always employs two. I don't care if it's a single-celled organism or if it's a human being. Every living thing requires two sets of huge molecules to get the thing done. Now, I want you to be sure that I'm reading this from Dr. Crick's book. I didn't say this, so I don't want to hear from anybody. Here's what he said. DNA and RNA are the dumb blondes of the biomolecular world, fit mainly for reproduction, but of little much use for really demanding work. Whew, I'm not touching that. That's right here on page 72. But I love to read that because you won't forget that. The DNA and the RNA are the dumb blondes of the biomolecular world. They're good for reproduction. That's about it. Sorry, blondes in the audience. But that's the truth in the biomolecular world. The proteins do all the work. You see, they're the workhorses. They're structural and they're enzymes. They do the work. The DNA and the RNA take care of the reproduction. And you have to have them both. That's why it's so difficult for evolutionists to explain how life got started in the first place. And let me tell you how difficult it is for Dr. Crick. He says in this book, this makes it especially challenging to explain how life started. And maybe 4 billion years, which is the time they put to the age of the earth, which, by the way, I don't necessarily agree with. Maybe 4 billion years isn't enough to get that done. So maybe he says in this book, somebody out there sent it to us on a spaceship. Can you imagine? This is a Nobel Prize scientist, ladies and gentlemen. And in this book, he proposes directed panspermia, which is a fancy name for saying some civilization out there or somebody sent the first living things here in a spaceship. Is there one scintilla of evidence that somebody sent first life here on a spaceship? Not one scintilla. But he spends the last 6 or 8 chapters describing what the spaceship might have looked like, what the thing might have sent here, and how it might have ended up on Earth. This is Francis Crick talking like some crazy person. But I'll tell you how bad it gets, ladies and gentlemen. They'll take any explanation over God. No matter how ridiculous it is. If it's a natural explanation that can be explained by some natural phenomenon, we'll take that over God. And that's what he does. Don't you believe me? You get this book yourself. The whole last section of this book is on directed panspermia, which is total fairy tales. Utterly incredible. All right, let's talk about how these things work. So here you go, class. This is our first chemistry slide. I'm going to get down here with you so we can look at this together. I'm pausing a little bit. I want you to take a good hard look at that. You notice at the top it says the 20 common amino acids occurring in proteins. These are the 20 common amino acids in every protein in every living thing. I don't care what the living thing is. Their proteins are made of this. So if you were in my class, students, you would memorize these 20. And I would drill you until you got it, unmercifully. There would be a quiz every day of the week till you got it perfectly. And then you would memorize their chemical structures underneath. And then you'd learn their abbreviations also. Because, ladies and gentlemen, this is foundational to everything else we're going to say. So you have to get it memorized. Now, I know you're quick, so I'm going to let you do that. Right now. You get those memorized right quickly here. Yeah, that's the first week. So now look, let me name a few of them. Glycine, notice that's G-L-Y. Alanine, A-L-A. Valine, V-A-L. And so on down to lysine, arginine, tryptophan, histidine. There's 20 of them. Fascinating, ladies and gentlemen. Single-celled organisms have proteins. They're made out of that. You have proteins. They're made out of that. Every living thing has proteins, and they're made out of exactly the same stuff. Now, let me tell you what an evolutionist does with that. Because part of my purpose in this class is to make you think like an evolutionist. And class, everything evolutionists said is not stupid. I don't like it when Christians say, evolution is so stupid, no human being could ever even think anything like that. That is not right. Besides, it's not nice to call people stupid. Remember I told you Richard Dawkins calls me stupid? I don't like that. Well, they don't like that either. Let me tell you how an evolutionist would explain why it is that all living things have the same chemistry. They would say to you, class, you have the same chemistry as every other living thing because you're all akin to each other. You all came from the same root. We're all in the same family tree with every other living thing. That's why we have the same chemistry. And that chemistry, what we started from, started in the ocean, and little single-celled organisms were formed first. And from them came all of the living things by natural causes. That's why we all have the same chemistry. That is not a stupid answer, class. That is one possible answer to why we have the same chemistry. Now, what do I say as a creationist? I say the reason we have the same chemistry is because a grand designer made us in such a way we can all feed on each other. How are you going to feed on something if it doesn't have the same chemistry you've got? You're going to be in big trouble. You'll have a lot of stomach aches. I believe it's a perfectly reasonable explanation to say that a creator doesn't have to start all over with everything he creates, particularly if it's going to be an intertwining system. So to have a common chemistry makes a lot of sense by design. You see? So which of those is correct? And I will tell you, that evidence by itself is not sufficient to convince you one way or the other. You need more. So we're going on. But it is a fact, class, that the chemistry of all living things are founded on the same chemistry. Man, I really jumped ahead here, didn't I? I got to quit smacking on this thing. All right, so there we are. You had a little preview of what's coming. Have you got these memorized? I'm sorry I took it off the screen. I'll give you another few seconds. All right. The fact is, every protein is a combination of these 20. It's very much like the letters of an alphabet form up the words in English. There's 26 letters in our alphabet. Every word you make up in English is a combination of those 26 letters, isn't it? How about the word anti-disestablishmentarianism? It's a combination of those 26 letters. How about cat? C-A-T. It's three of the letters in the 26. Well, proteins, class, are combinations of those 20 amino acids. So you line up amino acids in a row, and a string of them makes a protein. Now, is it okay if I get class to answer a question for me once in a while? This is choral reading, class. A string of amino acids makes a what? Protein. Okay? Every protein is a string of those 20. Now, I have to add a little proviso there. There are some proteins that have a little another amino acid in them, but there's so few it's not worth talking about. So, the proteins in living things are made of those 20. That's a fact. And I have to apologize to proteins for the lack of information I'm giving you. We should spend the next 6 years talking about proteins. That's how important they are. I'm really ashamed. And so I offer my apology to every protein for the limited information I'm giving you. But I want to turn my attention to the dumb blondes, because that's what I want to talk about tonight. So that's the DNA and the RNA. And you see this glorious structure right here? It's an intertwining strand. Two strands wrapped around each other. That's the structure that Francis Crick and James Watson are given credit for discovering in 1953. And it's since then, class, that the whole world of living things has opened up to us. You see, DNA has a certain characteristic structure. It's a double helix with crossbars. See if I can point this out to you. See, there's a strand right there, and here's another one wrapped around it, and you see these cross pieces here? That's the structure that they discovered. And it's because of that structure that it has the capacity to reproduce itself. And my job for the next few minutes is to explain to you how that happens. It should take me 6 weeks. I'm going to have to do it in less than 10 minutes. So I've got to talk really fast. Here's a DNA strand. You see how it's wrapped around itself over here and over here? And the DNA, it turns out, unzips. It comes apart. And as it does, it exposes this side and this side that were once connected up. You see? And on this exposed side here, there is an order of chemicals. They're called bases. And there's exactly four of them. Adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. I'll say it again. Adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. A, T, C, and G. There's exactly four of them. And there's combinations of those four all along here. Can you see that it says A, C, G, T, A, G, G, T, A, C, G, T, T, A, C, G, G, C, etc.? Those letters, class, are not there. The letters stand for the chemicals that are there. Now, here's another interesting fact. One of those always goes with the other one. Now, notice, if you've got a C over here, you always have a G over here. If you have a G over here, you got a C over there. If you got a T over here, you got an A. A and T go together, and G and C go together, like love and marriage and a horse and carriage. You know why they go together, class? Because of their chemistry. The chemistry of A fits exactly with the chemistry of T. And G sits with C. That's why they match up. If you were in my class, guess what you would memorize? All four of those and their chemical structures. You're not in my class, so you have relief. But you at least need to know there's four bases that go along the strand of the DNA, and they provide a code, ladies and gentlemen, that we have learned how to read. Now, before I leave this slide, I want you to notice something else. You see that glob right there? It's called RNA polymerase. I'll give you a little hint, class. If a word ends in A-S-E, it's an enzyme. And if you were listening closely a while ago, I told you that enzymes are special cases of proteins. Excellent. So there's a glob that rides along the DNA called RNA polymerase that allows it to unzip and expose the two sides. In addition to that, class, once it's unzipped, you got to zip it back up. You ever had trouble zipping up? Does your zipper ever get stuck? It's embarrassing. But did you know that also can happen with DNA? It can get stuck trying to zip back up. And let me tell you, class, it's most fascinating. There's a specially designed, may I say that, protein to help keep it from getting stuck. May I say specially designed? Sure looks like a design to me. But the fact is, to unzip DNA, you have to have proteins. And to zip it back, you got to have another protein. You with me? Okay, and when you unzip it, you expose this code here. And watch, you see this little blue strand right here? That's called RNA transcript. It's called messenger RNA. It is an exact mirror image copy of the information on the DNA. A copy is made, and then the RNA takes that information somewhere else. That's how the dumb blondes reproduce. They copy their information and send them off somewhere else. Is that fascinating? And we haven't touched the hem of the garment yet. Here, ladies and gentlemen, is the code contained inside DNA. And we have learned how to read it. And here's what we found out. DNA code has only three-letter words. How would you like that, kids? A language with only three-letter words. Cat, dog, pat, zip. Every word in the language is three letters. Well, that's the way it is in this language. It's all three-letter words. And every one of those words is made out of those four I told you about, A, C, G, and T. Four things taken three at a time. and you can repeat. Well, we could do a little math there. I always like to bring in math. Anybody you know combinations well enough to tell me how many words can you make if you can only make three-letter words and you only got four letters to make them and you can repeat the letters? How many words can you make? Let me tell you how to do it. It's four in the first position, right? You could have four different possibilities in position number one. You could have four in position number two and four in position number three. So how do you figure how many words? It's four times four times four. Do the arithmetic in your head. There's exactly 64 words in the genetic code. Let me show you how to read it off this chart. This represents the first letter, U, C, A, and G. And did you see that U right there? In RNA, the T becomes a U. Don't ask me why or how to explain it. That's a big old problem, but that's what happens. The T becomes U. Okay, so you've got U, C, A, and G. That's your first letter in the three-letter word. The second letter is across the top here, U, C, A, and G. And the third letter is over here, U, C, A, G, U, C, A, G, U, C, A, G, and U, C, A, G. And with that one page, you can read every word in the genetic code. It's a language, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm going to tell you precisely what it means. So don't you go to sleep on me. If U is the first letter, and U is the second letter, and U is the third letter, that's this one right here. U means phenylalanine. This is not a language that you pronounce. But if you did, well, how would you pronounce U, U, U? Ooh! The word ooh means phenylalanine. See that? Let's read the next one. How about U, C, U? That's this one right here. That means serine. Uku means serine. I know this is all very helpful. Let's go down here a little bit. How about A, U, U? A, U, U. That's au. That means isoleucine. Has anybody caught on yet? What you see up here, ladies and gentlemen, on the genetic code is all those 20 amino acids that you memorized a moment ago. Supposedly. That's why you needed to memorize those the first day of class. Because the genetic code is a code for those 20 amino acids. Now, are there some repeats up there? Yeah, there are. You see, phenylalanine is both UUU and UUC. There's two codes for phenylalanine. There's two for cysteine. There's four for serine, four for proline. There's some repeats in here. There's more than one code for the amino acids. Looks like a backup system to me. But the fact is, ladies and gentlemen, inside DNA is a code for the 20 amino acids. Is that amazing? Now, what do you do with it? Well, first of all, you've got to know there's more than just that. All the 20 amino acids are coded here, but there's also a code that says, start reading! The code AUG, which is that one right there, means methionine, one of the 20 amino acids, but it also means start reading. So picture in your mind now. You remember that strand that was unzipped and you had those codes exposed? Where do you start reading, class? That code is huge! DNA is a huge strand of information. So where do you start reading? When you see AUG, that's when you start reading. And then you start reading three-letter words. Three-letter word, three-letter word, three-letter word, three-letter word, three-letter word, three-letter word, each of which stands for an amino acid. And what else do you need, class? When do you stop reading? You could go on forever. There's also a code up here for stop reading. You see that? In fact, there's three of them. A-U-G means stop reading. So does U-A-G, pardon me, means stop reading. U-A-A means stop reading, and U-G-A. All those mean stop reading. They're called terminators. So when you come across one of those three codes, that means stop reading. Now watch, class. You started reading, you read a bunch of three-letter words, and then you stopped reading. Each three-letter word stands for an amino acid, so you got a string of amino acids. What does that make, class? A protein. Let me give you a hint. The answer to every question I'm going to ask you for a long time here is proteins. So you already know the answer, okay? So don't sit there. Answer my question. What's a string of amino acids, class? It's a protein. So what do you have in the genetic code? You have a code for building proteins that's tied up in the DNA. Every protein in every living thing is coded in the DNA. Now, class, if you were the jury and I were trying to convince you that living things were designed, as far as I'm concerned, I'm done. Because I've already demonstrated to you that there's a language in every cell of every living thing. We know how to read it, and we know exactly what it's coding for. Now, do you seriously, in your wildest imagination, think nature built a language by itself that codes for proteins? Can you believe that? Let me ask you, class, if some SETI guy who's looking into outer space received a signal from outer space with a language in it that you could decode and read, what do you think he would say? Isn't it interesting what the stars bleeped out? No, sir. Every headline in every newspaper would say, for the first time in history, we've received a signal from an intelligent civilization. But with it in every human cell and every other living cell on earth, we say, isn't it interesting how nature built this language? It's not believable, class. But we haven't even started to begin to start to look at the hem of the garment. That's just one tiny piece of what we're talking about here. But there is a genetic code, and it's in every living thing. What if we received a message from outer space with the genetic code in it? What do you think everybody would say? There is no question what they would say. So why can't we say that when the things are right here under our nose? Or how about in our nose? Every cell in your nose has this too. By the way, that's a really interesting subject, which I'm not going to get into. The SETI organization, if they found the genetic code, was certainly, and other reasonable people would certainly conclude that came from an intelligent source. And as far as I'm concerned, I rest my case, class. But there's so much more to tell you, so I can't stop there. There's so much more to the description of life as we know it, other than just the genetic code. That's just the beginning. That's the dumb blonde piece that allows it to reproduce. You've got to do something with that information, class. You see the DNA up here in the nucleus? That contains all that information. Most of the DNA in living things is in the nucleus. Not all of it. Some of it's elsewhere. But most of it's up here in the nucleus. So what you have to do is transcribe that information. That's the RNA piece of it. Then you have to mature that copy, which I'll talk about in just a moment. Then it has to migrate outside the nucleus, and it has to be picked up by two ducks hugging each other. Don't they look like two ducks hugging each other? That's not really what it looks like, class, but it makes a good picture. But the message that's copied up here migrates and then is picked up by the ribosome and translated so you can build a protein. Transcription, migration, translation. And every step in that process, class, requires... Thank you very much. You're catching on. In fact, it requires a bunch of proteins every step of the way. So you got the dumb blondes with all the information that it can reproduce themselves, but you got to have lots of proteins to make it happen. So let me just briefly look at this piece up here, and then I'm going to show you a little video clip, and Stacy's going to help me. Not yet, Stacy. I'm not quite ready for you. Don't get too anxious. All right, you see the DNA up here? It's making copies. You see how it unzipped? Class, what does it take to unzip DNA?
Protein.
Thank you very much. And then the copy is made, and then it comes down. You see this copy right here? That's the messenger RNA. You see those white spots in there? Those are called introns. And before the messenger RNA migrates, you have to clean up those introns. It's called maturing. So the introns are snipped out, and then you have your mature messenger RNA. Now let me just pause right there just a minute, because I'm coming back to this later. You know what an evolutionist says about that? He says, why would God make a system where when you copy it, then you got to clean it up? Why wouldn't he just make a system where it's all ready to begin with instead of having to snip out pieces of it? That doesn't make any sense. And the evolutionist would say to you, those introns right there are evidence for natural causes, not a designer, because that's a stupid design. Why would you make something that the copy has to be cleaned up first? Why not just make it right in the first place? You see? That looks like a makeshift thing that was just put together. And frankly, that's not a bad argument from their perspective. And I will tell you, I didn't know how to answer that. We're coming back to that a little later. But may I suggest to you, class, there will always be things, I don't care when it is or what time you live, there will always be things you don't know how to answer. So get ready for it. You will never be able to answer every question somebody asks. So what I believe is, you build a foundation of solid rock evidence for faith in God, and then if you can't answer something, you say, Joel, let's wait a while. Maybe we'll get to that later. But introns were a problem for a while, because they look like junk that you have to snip out and throw away. Why would God do that? They would say. Well, the fact is, there are introns, and they have to be snipped out, and you mature the messenger RNA, and then it migrates through the nucleus out here. And notice here, you see it coming out of that hole up there, and then it comes down here. This is the messenger RNA, and it's picked up by the ribosomes and translated three-letter word, three-letter word, three-letter word, etc., and out the bottom comes a chain of amino acids, which is a... That's how it works. Now, that's a very brief overview. Now, Stacy, can you come up and help me? The Signature in the Cell book that I showed you has a website. And we're about to show you a video clip that's on that website. So you can go home tonight, look up Signature in the Cell, go to the website, and watch the video again with their narration. I'm going to narrate it. I'm a better narrator, so I'm going to do the narration. And I want to do what I want to do with it. But you can listen to it again. So here we go. Do you see the DNA? Now, Stacy, you're going to just stop. Look, was he good? He has his finger on the button. And when I say stop, he's going to stop. Because I want to point out some things. This is it's not a photograph. It's a cartoon of DNA. Can you see the strand there? There's two strings wrapped around each other with cross pieces. So this is a three-dimensional model of the way DNA looks. So that's what we're looking at. And we're going to show you now how proteins are built. Okay? In 3D. Okay, here we go. No, can you mute it? Stop. Can you mute it? I don't want that sound. How do you mute it? We forgot to look at that, didn't we? Oh, he can figure it out. While he's doing that, you see, whoops, you had to get out of it first, huh? Oh, good. Look at there. Perfect. Now you're ready. Okay. Go ahead and click it, and I'm ready for you to move. All right. You see that beautiful thing? You see those letters in there? They're not there, class. They're just there to label those different things. All right. Stop. Okay. Here's the DNA as it is not unwound. And now we're going to watch, and we're going to watch what happens as the DNA begins to unzip. So watch closely. Here we go. Okay, stop right there. You see that glob right there? That's RNA polymerase, which class is A. Thank you, good. That's right. In fact, do you see the different colors there? It's a glob of several proteins that ride along the DNA strand and allow it to come apart. Without that, it doesn't come apart. You listening? I'm going to get to a point here in a minute, so don't miss what I'm saying. I want to say it again. How do you unzip DNA? You have to have
proteins.
You do. You cannot unzip DNA without proteins. Okay. Go right ahead. Let's let it ride for a little while. There comes another little glob. You see that? It's getting even fancier. It's even got wings. Okay, stop. This is what it looks like, not that other thing. It's a glob that rides along the DNA, and inside, copies are being made. And you see this strand right here coming out the side? That's the messenger RNA that's copied the information that now goes somewhere else. Okay? Make me feel good and do something with your head. You okay so far? So I don't think you're glazed over. All right, go ahead. All right, here we go. Do you see the RNA out there? Now, let's go down inside. Stop right there. Now we're down inside. The thing is now unzipped. You see that? There are the exposed sides made out of those four chemicals I told you, A, C, T, and G, that are in a certain sequence of three-letter sequences. And what's happening is the RNA is being formed by making exact mirror image copies of every one of those. So let's watch it happen now. Thank you. So here we go. That one made, and notice they bond in together. Stop right there. Folks, that's happening, and you're just sitting there, oh, look at that. Every step of that is a chemical reaction. You listening? Because one chemical is connecting up with another one, and then it's forming a chemical bond to make a chain. Every bit of that is complex chemistry. And we're just watching it. There's a lot of chemistry going on at an incredible speed. You know the other problem with this? It's way too slow. What you're watching here happen in seconds happens in micro-milliseconds. Vroom! Okay, go ahead. They can't make it go fast enough. That is so slow, it's pathetic. Slow! Okay, now it's releasing it into the outer part of the nucleus. Stop right there. There's your messenger RNA that has been produced from the DNA that's now migrating. Guess what it takes, class, to help that migrate? Absolutely. Okay, so here we go. We're migrating right along. And I want you to notice it's now coming to the wall of the nucleus. Stop right there. You see that wall? It's got holes in it. The nuclear wall has holes in it. Do you think any respectable nuclear wall just wants anything going through those holes? No, it does not. Only certain things go through those holes. And guess, class, what guards the hole?
Protein.
Thank you very much. That's exactly right. So watch, as you come up to that hole right there, Do you see that little round thing right there? Stop right there. See that thing right there? That thing is in the way. Can't get rid of that, can you? All right, it's okay. See that little round thing? That's a protein class. It's guarding that hole. Now watch what happens as the RNA comes up. Watch. It says, won't you come in? And it allows it to go right through. Stop right there. You see that? You think just anything go through that hole? No, ladies and gentlemen. Only what the protein allows. You think there's a lot more to this story than I'm telling you? Proteins don't just open up, folks. There's chemistry in that step. It is utterly amazing is what it is. And people sit around and talk about this and say, isn't it wonderful what we've discovered? Not giving the first thought to how did it get there in the first place? And do all this magnificent stuff like it's a finely tuned machine. It's what's happening. Okay, so we're migrating. Go right ahead now. So here's our RNA going out. So see it coming out of that hole? Stop right there. What about the other side of that hole? Do you think any respectable nuclear membrane wants something going back in there? No. What do you think guards the door? A protein, of course. Absolutely. Okay, so now the RNA has passed outside and it comes right over here and you see it's going to be picked up by the ribosomes, which does not look like two ducks hugging each other. It looks more like that. Now stop right there. Because you see now the messenger RNA that has the information from the nucleus off the DNA is now inside the ribosome ready to be read. Not only do we have a code class, but we have a system of chemicals inside your cells that know how to read the code. Utterly amazing. So as it passes through the ribosome, let's see what happens next. Stop right there. Here we are down inside the ribosome. You see how dark it is? We're down inside. And it's beginning to read these three-letter words here. C-A-C. Do you notice that the G matches the C, the U matches the A, and the G matches the C? You see this little glob right here? We haven't even talked about that. That's transfer RNA, which is another whole set of RNAs we haven't even discussed yet. Class, do you think I'm telling you everything? Folks, I'm not touching the hem of the garment. When I get finished, it will have been miserably incomplete. Because there's 1,000 other things we should have discussed that all work together in perfect harmony. Pardon me if I get excited. So here you've got it reading the code. Excuse me. Here's a three-letter word, then it goes to the next three-letter word. You see that transfer RNA? At the bottom of it is the first amino acid that forms that protein. That amino acid is the precise one that goes with that three-letter code right there. And stuck on the bottom of the transfer RNA. Look up there, class. The code's up here, and the amino acid's down here. And there's a bunch of chemicals in between that make the connection. Incredible. Now, what happens next? Oh, by the way, what do you think it takes to make that happen? Proteins. Did you know every one of those transfer RNAs has a specific protein just for it? That's 20 more proteins, class. This all doesn't just happen. The proteins are the workhorses. All right, so now come up to the next one. There's your next three-letter word. Stop right there. Now you've got three sets of three-letter words. You've got a three-amino acid chain. And an amino acid chain makes a protein. Class, do you seriously think there are any proteins out there with only three amino acids in them? Not a chance. You know how big an average protein is? 1,000 amino acids in a row. That's an average. Now, there are ones smaller than that. And there are ones much larger than that. On average, there are 1,000 amino acids in a row for an average protein. So what you're watching up here has to happen on average 1,000 times just to build one protein. You know how long it takes? And that wasn't nearly fast enough. All right, let's keep building. Watch, we're building this protein now. And the problem with this, it's so slow. It's like slow motion. Come on. It doesn't happen. That's slow. Move it. He's going to try to show you. Stop. Henry Ford never touched it, class, in his factories where we built Fords. He never touched this. And this happens every second. You've been sitting here listening to me. You know how many billions of proteins were built in your bodies while you've been sitting there? No wonder you're tired just from sitting. You have built billions of proteins just since you've been sitting there. You better be eating your amino acids. That's what the health guys tell you. There's several of those amino acids your body doesn't make, and if you don't eat them, you don't have them. You can't build proteins. This is not good. All right, so now, the protein is being built. All right, stop right there. Here's the RNA that's being read. You see that glob right down there at the bottom? That's your protein coming out the bottom. So keep going now. Watch this blob right here. That's the protein being built. And you'll notice, stop.
Sorry.
That's okay. That's the glob right there that forms the protein. Now watch, class. Eyes up here. Proteins are not just strands of amino acids. They most certainly are that. And by the way, every protein is its own unique strand of amino acids. Just like every word in English is unique, every protein has its own unique strand of amino acids. And it's specific to that protein. Right? Not only is it a strand, no protein just is sticking out here like this. Proteins wrap up into three-dimensional shapes that are also unique. So you've got a primary system of protein, of amino acids. You've got a secondary system that wraps, but there's a third. Every protein has to go through three stages. You saw it wrapping up there? Now watch. That's not enough because it goes over here to this other organelle. And let's go ahead now. And it goes inside that organelle, and I want you to watch closely this blob right here as it's inside this other organelle, and it's now shaping itself. You see how it's twisting and turning around there? And stop. There's chemistry in every piece of that. Until it forms itself into its precise three-dimensional structure. So it has primary, secondary, and tertiary characteristics. Every protein does. And if they aren't all there, it doesn't work. Does this look like a design to you, class? It is overwhelming, class. So when finally, go ahead, it is formed into its perfectly designed three-dimensional shape. And by the way, it doesn't change colors like that. It is released out into the cytoplasm to go do the work for which it was designed. And it's so interesting to me, class, that I read textbooks in chemistry and biology that talk just like that. The protein is released to go do the work for which it was designed, and then they say it wasn't designed. Nature just did this. Can you honestly believe, class, that the Darwinian method of evolution, small-scale changes over long periods of time, added up to make this process? There's problems with that so many I can't even number them. It's incredible to believe that happened by the Darwinian evolutionary model. Which is more reasonable? Somebody designed that? Or it happened by natural causes? You'll have to answer that. Okay, thank you. Stacy, excellent. Thank you very much. Now, I want you to watch closely. Here's the puzzle that Dr. Crick was worried about. with these two great classes of molecules? You got to have them both. The DNA contains the code, right, class? The genetic code's in the DNA. It takes many proteins to transcribe and translate the code, does it not? How many times did I ask you to say protein? There's at least 50 of them that are required to build one protein. The problem, though, is the proteins that are required to build a protein are themselves coded in the DNA. Please stay with me here. You remember that RNA polymerase that rides along the DNA? That's a protein. Question, class, how'd you get that RNA polymerase in the first place? The code for it inside the DNA. You have to have the RNA polymerase to read the code because that's how you unzip it. So how'd you make the first RNA polymerase? You couldn't unzip the DNA without it. You were listening to me? Every protein's the same way. How do you get there, class? It's a problem. That's why Crick says maybe 4.5 billion years on Earth isn't enough time. Folks, I'll give you an eternity. Nature is not doing this. To produce these proteins from the code requires the proteins themselves. So the problem is, which came first? It's truly the old chicken and the egg problem. Only worse. That's why he says somebody else sent it here on a spaceship. Now that really helps solve the problem, doesn't it? So how did it happen out there? That doesn't solve anything, class, except kick the can down the road. And that's a Nobel Prize winner. Incredible. Yeah, we're going to be real rational and look only at the evidence. Over 200,000 molecules are being built every second in every cell. The average enzyme can catalyze the reaction of over 100 molecules per second, and there's over 2,000 of them. That's 200,000. So, Brother Gene, how tired are you? Let's see if we can figure out how many billions of cells he has in his body. And every single cell produces 200,000 molecules every second you've been sitting there. No wonder you're tired. Did you have a big supper? Adequate supper. Folks, that's what's going on in your system at all times. Is that amazing? It's utterly amazing. But what about junk DNA? Now I'm going to throw a wrench at you, and I'm losing some of you. And I don't blame you. If I were sitting where you were, I'd be asleep probably. So I need your attention for about another 10 minutes. So here's what I want you to do. Everybody gets to stand up and shake yourself just a little bit. Don't get lascivious. But let's get the blood flowing. Stamp your feet if you have to. You know, in the kids' song, stamp your feet if you love the Lord. Okay, now you can sit back down. And nobody left. I'm so thankful. I'm doing this for one reason. I'll show you this book again. Dr. Francis Collins, who wrote this book, who was the leading light in discovering the complete structure of the DNA, the human genome, he says the human genome is a great evidence for evolution. Now, he's a believer in God, but he doesn't believe in it because of DNA. He says DNA is a grand testimony that evolution is how it came about. He believes God did it by the method of evolution. Let me tell you why he thinks that. Because we've now mapped the whole human genome. And what we've found out is a lot of stuff we didn't know before 2000, 2001, 2002. In the last 10, 15 years, we've learned a whole lot more since then. But when they started mapping the human genome, they found a bunch of interesting stuff. In fact, they found out over time, this goes back beyond that, like the 80s and 90s, they were beginning to discover, wait a minute, only part of the DNA is being used for this magnificent process I just described to you. In fact, it became clear that it's only about 5% of the DNA that's needed to build proteins. So what's the other 95%? At the first, as they began to uncover this, it became more and more obvious to them, they thought, that the rest of that DNA is probably leftover junk from your evolutionary past. And that's exactly what they began to say. 95%. In fact, I'll have to tell you, I was at USF doing one of these lectures in one of the lecture halls, and in the Q&A session, a professor stood up right back there, and he said, "Now, Dr. Payne," in his rather grandiose style, "you told the class tonight about this wonderful mechanism for building proteins, and I grant you, that's a wonderful mechanism. But what you didn't tell them is that only 5% of the DNA is needed to do that stuff. The rest of the DNA is junk. Why didn't you tell the class that?" "Well, I didn't know enough about it to talk about it." That was about 15 years ago. And I hadn't really studied that. And I was completely taken aback, class. And his question was, if God did this, then why would he make it 95% junk? I'm saying this to you, class, because this is what you're going to get hit up with. In every generation, there's going to be something that comes up, you don't know how to answer, that throws you for a loop, and you say, wait a minute, maybe everything I believed is wrong. I went through that, class, when I was a teenager. And I went through it again with this, not as badly, because I know better what I'm doing now. But what do you do with junk DNA? Only about 5% of the DNA is used for protein building. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a fact. You don't need all the DNA to build all those proteins. That's a fact. We only learned that in the last 15 or 20 years. Some say the rest of it is junk. But it gets worse than that, class. And I just want to give you a little tiny taste. Do you think we ought to take a month on this? Yes, and I'm going to take just a few minutes. I want us to understand that we're all ignorant, just in different fields. There's a whole lot I'm not telling you. There's a lot I don't know. And there's a lot any human being on earth doesn't know about how living things work. 95% junk. They have found whole stretches of DNA that looks like a desert. Just repeated stuff that's doing nothing. Just a bunch of repeated stuff, like grains of sand. You ever looked at the picture of the Sahara Desert? It's just sand everywhere. There are stretches of the DNA that look like just a bunch of repeated junk. Not doing anything. They call it long interspersed nuclear elements. Short for that is line, L-I-N-E. And then there are other sections of it they call signs because they're short internuclear spaces. And worse than that, there's a section in the human genome that they call a pseudogene for vitamin C. Here's what they say about it. That section of the DNA looks like it was designed to make vitamin C, but it doesn't. In a rabbit, that same section of the DNA makes vitamin C. In us, it doesn't. And in a number of other living things, in their DNA, it makes vitamin C, but humans do not produce vitamin C. Did you know that? That's why you better be taking your vitamin C. Your body doesn't produce it, so you got to take it in. But there is a pseudogene there, they say, that should be producing it, but it quit doing it. That's what they say. Why did it quit? It got mutated in the evolutionary process. It's a leftover of your evolutionary past. It's a pseudo gene that doesn't work anymore. Now, class, how would you explain that if you're a believer in God? It's a problem. And I'm only throwing a few things at you, class. That 95% junk is a big old problem for a creationist. And it was for a long, long time. So what do you do about that? I'll tell you what I do. I say, God, help me. Let me find out what's the deal here. I'll tell you what I've learned. If you're completely bamboozled, give it about 10 years. And we'll find out some more stuff. And I don't have time to tell you tonight about so many things that have been found out in the last 10 years. It's incredible. You live in the most exciting time humans have ever lived. We're uncovering every day of the week something new about DNA. It's thrilling. And Dr. Collins knows very well. And by the way, he's backed off of his junk DNA thing. Because he embarrassed himself by saying that. I said to that professor, by the way, that night, I said, sir, there has been some history of science in which people said things were leftovers of their evolutionary past and they got really embarrassed by it. I would be very careful not to call something junk until you know more about it. And the fact is, class, we've learned all kinds of things about supposedly junk DNA. And I recommend a good little book here by Dr. Jonathan Wells called The Myth of Junk DNA. And it is full of information of what we learned about that supposed junk. So I'm going to give you a flash treatment right now. There's evidence for specific biological functions of the non-protein coding DNA, which is about 95% of it. We're finding out that RNAs from this DNA play significant roles in controlling whether, where, and to what extent protein coding regions are transcribed. Folks, that junk is making a bunch of RNAs that we didn't even know about before. A whole lot of it's being copied, we just didn't know what they were doing. And those RNAs appear to have an impact on the other RNAs. What we're learning is it's a whole lot more complex than we ever dreamed. Those introns, you remember what I mentioned about those introns, those little white things that have to be snipped out? You know what we're learning about those that we thought was leftover junk, and why would God do that? Here's what we're learning. They are rich in splicing factor recognition sites. They encode a majority of the small RNAs. Did you know those little introns code for RNAs also? We had no idea. And those little small RNAs they code for do all kinds of fascinating things we're just beginning to learn about. So they were accusing God of making a mistake, and instead what we're learning is there's more to that than we ever dreamed. And it's all working together. And we're just starting to begin to think about understanding some of this. The RNAs from introns influence gene expression by modifying chromatin. Don't have time to talk about that. Densely concentrated specified information. There are multiple messages stored in the same sequence of bases, ladies and gentlemen, and there are specific proteins called spliceosomes and editosomes. You remember that stretch of RNA that had to be snipped out? Guess how that's done, class? By proteins. They snip out those introns and they edit them back together and they form the mature RNA. Let me tell you what we found out. The same stretch of RNA, now we believe, in many instances, can make as many as 1,000 different proteins from the same stretch. I just lost you. We've now learned, class, that one stretch of code can make as many as 1,000 different proteins because they get reorganized and shuffled around to build different proteins by the spliceosomes and editosomes, about which we knew nothing 15 years ago. Call it junk? Wash your mouth out with soap. Let's see here. Let me get rid of that. There are codes within codes. There are dual and overlapping messages. Are you kidding? Let me give you an example in that book, The Myth of Junk DNA. There was a woman in the military in the Revolutionary War. She was a homebody. Her husband was off at war. She wrote him a letter. And in the letter it said, "Dear sweetheart, things are going well here at the farm. We've got so many bales of hay and so many this and so many that." And she described what was going on in the farm, talked about the kids and their school and blah, blah, blah. It was a wonderful letter about things going on at home. But if you knew the code, tied up in that letter was another code that told where the military was of our enemies, where their munitions were, how many there were. If you knew the code, inside the code, you knew what was going on with the enemy. Now, class, in the deepest heart of your imagination, can you believe that codes inside of codes could be developed by natural causes, by the blind forces of physics? I mean, it reaches the point of impossibility, class. But that's what's going on in us. That 95% junk, in many instances, it's helping undecode codes inside of codes. Have I told you enough? No, I haven't. Because there's a whole lot more where that came from. The pseudogenes. What we're finding is some have produced functional proteins, others produce RNAs that suppress the expression of their corresponding functional genes, some produce RNAs that increase the expression of their corresponding functional genes. What we're learning is those supposed pseudogenes are doing other stuff. Watch what you call a pseudogene. And those repetitive non-protein coding DNAs, the lines and the signs and the endogenous retroviruses, what about all that stuff? We're learning they have vital roles to play. Even that massive desert, it appears, has a critical role. Well, I'm going to pass on from there. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I presented you a case tonight that in living things there's a language. We've learned how to decode and read it, and we know exactly what it's doing. It is a code that allows us to build proteins at a rate of 200,000 per second by a massively complex system of proteins interacting with the DNA and the RNA. It's better than any factory any human being ever built. It is by far more complex than any computer any man ever constructed. And do you sincerely believe, class, that that system, which is very obvious to us, and we know very well, came about by natural causes? If you can believe that, you have greater faith than anybody in Israel. I can't believe it. Everywhere we look, says Michael Behe, in his wonderful book, Darwin's Black Box, from the microscopic to the macroscopic, things look like they're made. Richard Dawkins spends 300 pages trying to convince you they're not really made. Nature did it by the blind forces of physics, by natural selection, acting upon natural variation. I say to you, class, it is so much more reasonable to believe that a grand designer put this together. They're not even in the same ballpark. But my position is excluded from public schools. Is that incredible? Now I ask you, class, in this entire last discussion, have we used the Bible? I haven't touched it. I don't recommend you use the Bible in this discussion. Is there enough powerful evidence to convince someone there's a God without touching the Bible? The Bible even says that. And I think it's not the right approach to start quoting Genesis when you're discussing with an atheist. Just go to his own evidence. When you have the privilege, class, of getting there and doing experiments where you're messing with things that are so magnificent that you're thinking God's thoughts after him, you ought to be in awe. And our generation is not. And shame on them. We've gotten so prideful about what we know that we've forgotten we don't know anything compared to what there is to know. And that's my lesson tonight, class. I thank you for your kind attention. It was too long, but I can't quit in the middle of that stuff. So thank you for staying with me. And it did help to stand up, didn't it? I'm glad you did.